Hey, Larry, how are you tonight?
Doing great, Andy. How are you?
I am well. So this is week two recording on the new platform. I got some feedback last week that everything sounded, someone said we sounded like we were in the same room. I'll take that as a compliment.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. We've been fighting with issues related to my internet connection and with various issues that I can't explain at my pay grade, but I'm glad to hear that.
So that's good. And in as another exciting announcement, we have a branded YouTube channel. If you all want to, you can go to youtube.com/c/registrymatters. We did it. Thank you guys very much. So currently we have 105 subscribers, which is over the 100 limit, and that gets us what I wanted to get to. So I'm excited.
And you mean the 100 minimum, not limit?
Correct. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, we
Yeah,
needed 100 minimum.
we could have 47,000 subscribers.
We could. We would actually make money probably if we had that many.
And we're going to. This show is growing every week. We're just adding out the wazoo, whatever that means.
What does a wazoo mean, right?
I don't know. I've heard it all my life.
Huh. That's kind of like one of those words like mulligan. There's a movie where they actually attributed mulligan to somebody that just made a terrible, terrible goof, and then everything in the town they said, "Oh, you did a mulligan."
What is a mulligan? I've never heard that.
In the movie, it's a bowling movie, and they attribute to messing up to just making a just a goof, I guess you could say. And they attribute it to somebody's dad, somebody's granddad, whatever, and his name was Mulligan.
Aha.
Mean it has no relevance to anything.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, so now you're in the know of that word, Mulligan. And this show is supported by our patrons. Can't thank you guys enough for helping bring this podcast to everyone. And we are trying to reach, look, we're trying to reach registrants. We're trying to get people to get on board, to be motivated to try and make changes. And obviously, there are costs associated with it, with hosting and equipment, and obviously the time involved. So that's what the show is about, and the patrons help bring it to you. And if you would like to support the show directly, you could go to patreon.com/registrymatters and help support the show. And we would be eternally grateful if you did.
Oh, that's right. We can afford our Caribbean cruises
That would be awesome.
and our Super Bowl tickets and you name it. We can do it if enough people support the podcast.
That would be amazing to we would have a live studio booth at the next Super Bowl.
Well, the joking aside, I mean, well, don't expect we'll ever get to that level, but there's a fair amount of work that goes into putting this together in terms of time commitment. We don't just sit and chat. We do research, figure out what we're going to talk about. And we try to read the articles, at least a brief read, skim of the articles. I'll read as much as I can, but we do spend the effort to bring the podcast. It's not just a couple of guys getting together and having a chit chat, at least not from my perspective. And I know that Andy puts a lot of work into editing it and reviewing it and figuring out where to put the time stamps and all this kind of stuff and getting it distributed. So there's a lot of work that goes into it.
Do you think that we can legitimately say we have a market cap of, I mean, there's 800-ish, 900,000 of us on the registry, but throw that out to 1 or 2 degrees of separation to parents and brothers and sisters and kids and spouses, you'd think that we have a market of 3 or 4 or 5 million people that would want to that should be interested in listening to this.
You would think so. You
Is that
really
fair,
would.
though?
I think it's fair. The 800,000, I always think it's overblown because people are in custody, people are dead, and people are on dual registries because of
Yeah.
their situation. But even if you've only got 550, 600,000 that are in the living and not duplicates, when you do the multiplier effect of the family, everybody has a family of some sort, more or less, and you'd think that we have a potential audience of well over 1 million people, a couple million people, and to get a small fraction penetration of that would be tens of thousands, and I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to reach that. But it's been a struggle in terms of trying to do the same math with reaching registrants and get financial
Yeah.
support for the cause. It's sad that we don't have more support, but I think easily we should be able to have a market of 10,000 listening to the podcast.
I would say challenge me to break the server that we're hosted on that I need to make a bigger server. That's what I would say challenge.
And what will it take to break the server?
I don't know, man. It's bored to death right now, even with the other couple websites that host it. It doesn't get any traffic. Not in that respect. I'm not saying you know, it's just sitting there bored to death, but it could handle a lot more. Just to deliver a podcast wouldn't take any effort. It's not like people are hanging out and listening. It's just as a file download generally.
Well, and this would be like any other program. Nobody other than the people who are in the production of the Rush Limbaugh program are listening to the entire 3 hours, 5 days a week. You tune in when it's convenient and you listen to the part that's interesting to you. Well, if we talk an hour and a half every week, there may be times when a person may not want to hear the whole hour and a half. They may want to hear a particular segment and they may skip a couple of weeks. But you would think with the churning of the audience of people who are coming in and out that we would have a significant number of people that are coming in on a weekly basis. But
you would think we'll keep trying
to do better.
Share it with all the people that you know. You know, that reminds me. So I told you about a guy at the handler office that I ran into. And so here's a guy, he's been out for, you know, not any specifics about the person, but he'd been out for a couple years. He's still in treatment. He doesn't have any sort of foreseeable end to his treatment. And his handlers say that he can't use the internet, which obviously creates a significant challenge to deliver a podcast to someone, because we are a quote unquote internet delivered radio show. This guy is effectively unreachable of a product that he needs to be receiving.
And it's unfortunate because a blanket internet ban is very problematic from a legal standpoint. I could possibly conceive of a situation where a total ban might be justifiable and would be upheld by the courts. But most of these, when they're told that they're not allowed on the internet, with a minimal amount of resources in the legal arena, they could have those knocked down. But they don't have the resources. It's one of the things I constantly gripe about how inadequate our country is in terms of providing people that are indigent or marginally indigent the resources to fight that. That's a totally, totally inappropriate to totally ban someone from the internet. But they can do it until they're stopped.
Yeah, and I literally told the guys, like, well, can they do that? I said, well, I mean, until they're challenged. I said, they can do it until they are told to stop. Now, like, legally, can they do it? I said, you know, you get problem. I told them that it seems, I guess, if you're caught with, come up with some ridiculous number, if you're caught with 10,000 images of little kids doing naughty things, that seems somewhat appropriate to ban them from the internet. Is that, am I off the deep end there?
You're kind of getting off the deep end, because the technology has evolved in terms of monitoring, and I'm out of my league in terms of explaining that. But they have sufficient tracking capacities nowadays that they can give them very limited access to the internet, and have boundaries in terms of what type of sites he can go to, and possibly even during certain hours. But to totally ban him from the internet is very problematic from a legal point. But I can assure you, he probably has no money. He has no one to turn to, and he's stuck in our country of many things that we don't do well at, which is providing adequate representation for people who don't have financial resources to carry it. And so he's probably going to be stuck in this conundrum.
Can you flip that over and give me something that you would see where, like, yeah, okay, I can see them doing an internet ban?
A total ban would be hard for me to come up with a scenario because of the capacity to monitor. I can see a very rigidly controlled access, but a total ban, you just can't.
Let's make the assumption the other direction, that he doesn't have some kind of CP charge and he just has some other kind of contact violation, not internet related at all, and they've made an internet ban. Now you're way out of the arena of making an internet ban. Now you're just being a jerk and saying you can't use the internet because you want to be a jerk.
And that could be what's happening in his case. Yeah. He may have an officer who's not very nice, and they're just being as unreasonable. And they can be like school bullies. They target people that they know that don't have the resources to fight back.
It's really terrible.
How often did the school bully target the big captain that weighed 200 pounds that could bench 290 pounds himself? How often did you see that person getting bullied when you were growing up?
Yeah, they don't do that because, you know, obviously there's pushback. So you bully the people that can't push back.
So you take a person who earns $100,000 a year despite their registry conviction, they have the capacity to probably retain legal services. And if they're well-spoken and seem educated, it's going to be a whole lot easier to target the person who has very limited education and who has an entry-level job or no job at all. That's where you're going to get the least pushback.
Right. What a mess. Well, let's get started. So there's an article that came out of The Economist, and it says, why support for the death penalty is rising again. And totally, they're like, the reason why this just intrigued me is we constantly hear the argument from people that says, well, if it saves only one, and that's in regards to the registry. So we're so interested in saving that one child. And we effectively, this is my estimation, we effectively don't care about kids being shot in school. That's why we won't do anything about the Second Amendment. But as you often state, well, if it saves only one, we'll trample these people's constitutional rights if you'll trample them on the other side too. But then throw in this one, you're killing people. You know, we are willfully killing someone. And there are many, many cases where they find out, obviously after the fact, because you can't undo, that they were wrongfully executed.
Well, I'm only going to be able to speculate, but we've had a heightened, almost to a shrill level about how dangerous the country's become since the 2016 campaign about all violence. And you hear these the immigrants, if they happen to, whether illegal or illegal immigrants, if they're connected with a crime, particularly a violent one. And I suspect that the portrayal of immigrants who are committing heinous crimes has probably played into that uptick in support for the death penalty, because we've got to do away with these people. We've got to do something about it. And I'm unhappy to see that the support is climbing for the death penalty, because I was one of those who mistakenly believed at one time it was a deterrent, it was the right thing to do. As I've aged and realized, learned more about the death penalty, it's all wrong, and we should not be executing people. We have a hard time restoring them if we were wrong. That's one thing. But the way it's applied, economics has a lot to do with it. Education. There's too many factors where the death penalty is real problematic.
And I against all other crimes, you can treat the victim, you could treat the perpetrator of it, but if you execute them, you're just done. You know, I'm a keyboard a computer nut, so Control Z means undo. There's no Control Z.
Nope. Well, and despite all the hoopla about the rising crime rate, the main reason for the drop in America's murder rate from 10.2 per 100,000 in 1980, which was the year Ronald Reagan got elected, to 4.5 in 2014. So the murder rate in America in that generation of time dropped by more than 50%. Hmm. At the time where you thought that the crime rate was going through the sky, it was actually plummeting. but then we're hearing these high profile cases that are causing people to say, well, we're being overrun by crime. No, we're actually not.
Yeah. It does seem that we are, that doesn't then seem to be very much different than the whole stranger danger issue. If the news just reports bad crimes, they don't ever show you what the actual statistics are, but because we have the 24-hour news cycle, it's just constantly in your face. You think that there's crap happening all the time. You think that kids are being taken off the street at every corner, when in fact, I can't remember if it's in this sequence tonight, but I just read, like, there maybe were 100 or so legitimate, like, abducted children in the past year.
It's in tonight's...
It's from the New York Times, from Lenore Skenazy, and we'll get to that towards the end.
It's in tonight's, and that's a typical 100. If you are one of those 100 parents who has a child abducted, of course it's very important to you.
Of course.
Because it's 100, but we got to keep it in perspective. It's out of 330 million. Yeah. We have 100 to 125 stranger abductions per year. Of the thousands of children that go missing every year, most of them are abducted by non-custodial parents.
Right.
And I can't change that. That's the reality of the situation.
Yeah.
But one child, if it's yours, is the most important one.
Of course.
But it's not a huge problem in terms of children being swept off of their bicycles and carried away. It's if you've got 100 a year in a country of 330 million, the chance of a child vanishing at the hands of a stranger are very, very slim.
And then how does that translate to public policy where are we just going after the squeaky wheel? Okay. So you have a Wetterling kind of thing, or you have a Megan whatever her name is, You have those kind of things that just make all the news and all the press, and everyone demands something be done. But it is such an outlier. But that's not what influences public policy. What to me should be influencing public policy is cool heads like actual criminologists or sociologists putting forth evidence of, hey, this worked over here in this environment like this. Here's what the policies were. But that's not what we do. We just knee jerk and we go, oh my God, we need to get our pitchforks and torches and we need to go climb up to the castle and burn it down.
Well, that brings the emotion back into it, that public policy, when you have a less than well-informed, and gee, I'm trying to be nice tonight, a less than well-informed citizenry, and that's what Americans are, they're less than well-informed. When you have them demanding that something be done for emotional reasons, and you live in a democratic society where people, their very office is decided by people who cast a vote, what are they supposed to do, flip you the middle finger and say, you're nuts, we're going to do what the hell we want to do? Then you get criticized for not representing the will of the people.
And then also throw in economics into it, because the people that are propping up your campaign with the biggest voices are the ones that are donating the money, or I should word that backwards. The ones with donating the money are the ones with the biggest voices. They're going to be the ones that you're beholden to, mostly, not the people, but the ones that are donating the money.
You certainly are going to give them freer access, more access, because it takes money to run campaigns. And I tell people, when you talk about levels of elected officials, you've got elected officials that are almost volunteers. A legislator in New Hampshire gets paid $100 per annum.
You can retire on that, right? You can buy your yacht in the Caribbean.
A legislator in my state gets a per diem when they're in session or on legislative business. It's about $160-$170 per day.
Yeah.
Well, if you've ever stayed in Santa Fe, that's probably about what it takes you to live on a day.
Sure.
So these people, they need money to run for office, unless, of course, you only want the elite to be able to afford to serve. And it's hard to imagine that the elite can represent you, because they don't know your struggles. But you need campaign donations to be able to run for office. It costs money for mail. It costs money for media. It costs money to some degree for social media, although those platforms are free. But it costs money to, in terms of figuring out how to push it out and craft the message. And social media is not completely free. And there,
well, again, yeah, I'm sure maybe someone can manage that on their own in the very small city council kind of arena. But when you move up to state level representatives, or then federal level at the state level stuff. Hey, I'm representing 700,000 people. I need someone to help me manage that kind of Twitter account or Facebook account. So now you have to hire people.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, I can't explain other than I think that there's been so much hoopla about crime that's probably explained some of the rise in support for the death penalty.
Yeah. It's just sad. Well, and then we don't even have to go down the whole rabbit trail of the chemical concoctions that they're using these days. And didn't you say that a state has reinstituted like firing squads?
I think that was Utah, but yes, I think.
Good grief.
Well,
I can't even comprehend that one. That sounds so, I don't know, 1890s or something like that. It doesn't even sound like anything.
Why don't we bring back the guillotine?
Sweet. And do public square kind of head choppings.
Yeah, do the guillotine. Everybody that tells me that that claims to be an expert claim you don't feel anything. It's hard for me to imagine you wouldn't, but they say you don't.
Yeah, we would have to have an offline conversation. I have a theory about how that actually all goes down. You would definitely know about it.
I would think you would feel it for the time it would take your body to die.
Yes, that's pretty much what
your
I was
brain.
Thinking.
Yeah.
Yep. So. Even though it's disconnected, it's probably still working for at least a little while.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then out of the Buffalo area, Buffalo News, sex offender gets jail for not reporting social media password. This is just ridiculous. So, you know, back to the person that I met that says, quote unquote, I can't use the internet. So here's a guy who's been out for 14 years. He's been out since 2004 of a misdemeanor even. And he's reported that he had two social media accounts and he only gave one password. And then he gets up to 4 years in prison for not reporting the password. Come on, man. Seriously?
Well, what struck me about this was that it said a level one sex offender from Tuscarora Indian Reservation.
Right.
Well, Tuscarora, I think that was there was a episode of the Andy Griffith Show where they,
Oh my God.
where there was a guy teaching Opie how to cheat the vending the gumball machine, and he
Okay.
said it was magic, and he said you say Tuscarora, and then you tap it,
Seriously?
and so when I read this, I thought, well, gee, but this is one of those things where there's not enough in the story. It was just
Yeah, I
really a
know.
blurb, but I would be curious to know more if we can find out without spending tons of resources, because I think this person might have a constitutional challenge. I don't think that the courts would look very kindly on having to give up your passwords.
Tell me more
And
about that. Is that Fifth Amendment stuff?
I think there's a I think that that would suppress your if they could go access any of your communications at any time with passwords. And I think some other states have tried that, and I think that there's been challenges where the passwords have been given up on. So
Right.
I'm interested in this. If this is a, when it says Tuscarora Indian Reservation, this may be a tribal
Yes.
requirement and rather than a state requirement, because I've never heard of this being a state of New York registration requirement.
Well,
It
you
may
mentioned the
be.
password thing of giving it up being a challenge. I know that a listener of ours in Tennessee, and I'm pretty sure a constant a Patreon supporter in Florida, they both have told me that they have to go give up all of the accounts. And I know the Tennessee guy, he has to give up passwords because he's the one that told us maybe 6 months ago. He was asking about, should I like write it down and have them sign the contract that I gave it to him?
Well, I think it's extremely problematic on the password end, because you do have some right to anonymity, and that would give them access to your communications continuously.
And I would argue, suppose you are in a position where you have a client's password to some sort of system on their business end. Well, yeah, I have the password because I need access to do some kind of work on it. You government don't have access to theirs by proxy of me.
I would agree with you. I would be curious. Why don't you assign one of our highly compensated research assistants to track this down, find out a little bit more about this case, if this is under Indian tribal law,
I'll tell
and
you what. So, Brian in New York, try and find out some more information about it. How's that? One of our
well, and
listeners.
then and then we've got Charles in New York, our wonderful United Kingdom
Oh,
guy, who,
okay. And he does a lot of legal research already, right?
yeah, he does.
So there
He's
you go.
very brilliant.
Excellent. So we have two people in New York that we can put our fingers on and just try and do some sort of research. Find out, is this this sounds like it's federal oriented, but it's from a tribe, Indian tribe up there.
Yeah, they probably adopted the territories and the tribal lands were just given the model AWA by the feds. The model's online, and they probably just did very little tweaking. And this would be a tweak, because there was no requirement in the model federal legislation to include passwords. And this may be a renegade officer that's asking, demanding that. Well, I guess not, because he went to jail, the Niagara County Jail, for not telling authorities. So at least it's been through some judicial review.
What a mess.
It's sad for a misdemeanor that he's going to be incarcerated for not giving up his password.
Well, all right. Then from the Marshall Project, you know what? It's like every week we have something from the Marshall Project. And this relates to the recently signed Senate Bill 10, I guess it is, in California, taking away, I'm pretty sure it's all bail, but there are some blind spots that some of the advocacy groups came across in the way that maybe it was the bill kind of changed towards the end, the 11th hour kind of additions or whatever. But some of the major groups, Human Rights Watch and ACLU, they disavowed the law completely. And out of the article, what seemed to stand out to me, if judges are given the power to do more with bail and sentencing things, then don't you drive right down the path of Judge Persky of not doing what the will of the people is? So then they start kicking out judges for you've given the judge the authority to make decisions, but you've totally put it back on the people to throw them out of office for not doing what they want them to do.
You hit it right, Andy. That's the we've got a high profile case out of house here where the judges are being criticized significantly for not holding them without bail on that high profile case of the child dying on the in the compound, and the judge found that the state had not met the burden that they have to show that the person is a significant danger to the community. And that's what you're going to have here. And the according to this article, it says the bill in the 11th hour was hijacked, said Gina Clayton Johnston, founder and executive director of SC Justice Group, a nonprofit that works with women and incarcerated family members. We entered this a really pragmatic way. The fact is, matter is, the bill takes us backwards. And that's always my fear. That was my fear when we passed the Constitutional Amendment here to hold people without bail. And it's exactly playing out. But when you do away with the flawed system of at least a bond being set for a person, and you have to go through all this evaluation process, and except for the lowest level, it says people accused of low-level misdemeanors will be booked and released within 12 hours. But everybody else has to sit in jail to go through this assessment process, however flawed it is. And they hope that it comes within 24 hours, but there's no guarantee that it will. And if the people, if it says that they rank as high risk on their assessment tool, then they have to see a judge. Okay. And this is going to result in a lot more people being held pre-trial or under extremely harsh pre-trial conditions, even if they're released, in terms of reporting and electronic monitoring and urinalysis and stuff. And you're supposed to be presumed innocent. I share that we've got problems with our cash bail system, but I haven't seen the ideal solution yet.
Do you know much about the New Jersey one that went into effect roughly a year ago?
I do not.
I heard a podcast recently talking about it, and I would then ask you to tell me what the quote unquote flawless system is, or less flawed. And this one, I think there are seven. I'll call them disciplines or something like that, or domains that they look at. They're looking at age of the offense, and not the age of the offense, the age of the offender at the time of the offense. They look at race, they look at socioeconomic background, and so forth. And I think in New Jersey, they had to do a constitutional amendment because they had in their constitution that you had to go through a bail process. So they had to remove that, and now everyone gets out. No one is held on bail except for the most extreme of offenses, something along those lines. I could have some of the details kind of murky, but a large number of people, like the jail has been cleared out. But they profiled, we've talked about these kind of things, but they profiled somebody who was walking down a street. The police saw him. They thought he was somebody else. They arrested him. They said he had a gun. There was no weapon produced, and he ends up like in jail for 6 months. Bail was set to, I think, 50. His family couldn't come up with the 10%. So here he is. He's just languishing in jail off of $5,000. Eventually, the judge moves it down to like 30. So he was able to get out. His family put him up on $3,000 bond. But what happens in 6 months? You lose your job. You lose your house. You lose your things. It's just like, what? And he ultimately ends up to be 100% innocent, wrongfully accused.
Tragic story, and there will be more of those stories, but there's no perfect answer. The cash bail system is flawed. It's totally unfair to people who like resources. I couldn't argue if that's not true, but I couldn't see the solution. It's kind of like I have a very soft spot for people who are homeless.
Yeah.
I was in the housing business for many years. Well, I don't like substandard housing. I sure don't. I find it very distasteful that substandard housing exists. The problem is, a lot of the people that live in it create the substandard is by their abuse. But even substandard housing is preferable to no housing. If you take a person who's living in a overnight, night by night, or weekly hotel that's very run down, they're somewhat safer in there, of course, if it doesn't burn up, than they are out on the streets, with no protection at all from the elements and from other criminals. Well, that's the thing we're dealing with bail reform. Right. We're taking a system that's flawed, trying to come up with a less flawed system. In some case, we're trading one set of flaws for another, where a person just can't get out, and they should be out. And under the old system, they would have been able to get out. And they sit in jail because of the scoring and the evaluation factors, and that shouldn't be. We keep looking. I'll have to look at the New Jersey. Why don't we sign that to one of our researchers to to bring us a report about how that system works there.
Well,
and I'm being a little bit of a smart aleck, but that's part of the preparation that goes into getting ready for one of these. In order to be able to talk about these things, we have to actually look into them.
Well, I'm trying to think of though. This is part of my like evolving understanding that we do just present words to people. So we say innocent until proven guilty, but I'm convinced that generally speaking, yes, people will be able to recite that back. You are innocent until proven guilty. However, you would not be accused of something if you were not guilty of something. Therefore, you're already guilty as soon as you got accused. And that's not at all what's going on. Specifically, like with that case I just referenced about the guy that gets completely falsely accused. He's 100% innocent and should be considered innocent, as should everybody. You should be given, unless you are deemed a serious flight risk, threat, whatever, you should be given, you know, maybe 12 hours sitting in the tank, whatever, for them to process you, book you, and then you should be free to go. Everybody.
Well, it sounded like what you just said is you're not speaking for yourself, that people, because they're accused of something, they're guilty of something. That's the perception of the public.
Correct.
That they're being accused of something, they're guilty of something. That's where it would be really nice if the establishment that prosecutes people, and that would include you, Mr. Police, and it would include you, Mr. Prosecutor, if you would, at the same time you release your statement saying that you've charged these people, if you would also say, and this is our opinion, but they are presumed innocent until a court of law finds them guilty. You never do say that. The only time you say that is when it's a law enforcement officer. And then you magically say, whoa, well, there's another side to this. There's a whole bunch of this that you haven't seen. These are just small segments that you know, and there's a lot you don't know. I would really like it if you would do the same thing when you haul someone in and you do your perp walk. I wish you would walk up to the microphones and say, and of course they're presumed innocent. And of course, this is just our opinion. And we hope to be able to convince a jury of 12 that they are guilty beyond reasonable doubt.
Following Twitter now with the podcast Twitter account, seeing all the things people were saying about Manafort, and I kept coming back, and I asked you at some point in time, you know, so he has access to making phone calls and he has a laptop, and I was like, is this normal? You're like, just remember, it's pre-trial. He should have access to do all the research and all that stuff and maintain some level of life prior to being convicted of anything. I was like, oh yeah, okay. So I had to push back against some people on Twitter that's like, he's still not convicted of anything yet. He's just accused of.
Well, he's now convicted. But
Yes, I know.
At that time. And he was getting probably a little special treatment because of the high-profile nature. The judge wanted to make sure that they got it right, that they did.
Because he is going to be able to afford $1 million attorney to find any little discrepancy and you know, crucify the court for doing something wrong or the prosecutor for doing something wrong.
It would be nice if we made sure we got it right in all the cases.
Sure.
It'd be nice if we treated pretrial detainees with the same flexibility that they had access. Very few county jails where you can think of where a person would be allowed that type. You'd have to go get a special court order if you were trying to give a pretrial detainee that type of access to help with their defense. They're usually in a jail with virtually no access to communications to the outside world, a very expensive telephone recording that says every 90 seconds, this is originating from a correctional facility, and it has been recorded and monitored for security. So the price you're paying for the phone call is being overstepped by that. And then you get that access once or twice a week, and you have no internet access usually whatsoever. Library access, the county jail, forget it. And you dress as if you're convicted. You're fed as if you're convicted. Can you name a jail that you've seen where any pretrial detainees were treated any differently than the people that were convicted?
No, not at all. I mean, where I ended up for, you know, 4 or 5 months, whatever, it was, you were screwed. I mean, you were just,
well,
you were.
But if we truly did believe that, wouldn't the elected sheriff who's running that jail say, Mr. County Commissioner, Madam County Commissioner, I have to treat the people that are pretrial differently because they're presumed innocent, and I wear this badge of honor, and it's my job to make sure that we follow the rule of law, and I need to give these people different treatment. Wouldn't that be a great day if a sheriff actually did that?
Yeah, it would be interesting that, you would have some kind of dorm segregation, obviously, you know, like a different area where things are treated closer to home, I guess you could say. Yeah, you're still in detention, you're still locked up, but perhaps less lockdown time, less restrictions on phones and the hours that you can use them and all that stuff. That would make, yeah, I, God, but how do you get there? How do you get when we have a society that immediately thinks that you're guilty as soon as they say you're accused of?
And that's what I was going to say. And the reason why a sheriff will never do that is because the average person believes that they must be guilty of something, and the police wouldn't have hauled them in because the police are overworked and understaffed, and they would never bring a BS case. So therefore, they must have done something. And you would never survive the electorate if you took that attitude. I said that tongue-in-cheek. I know that no sheriff is actually going to do that. The last one that probably did it was Brad Leach up in Boulder, Colorado, and he's been out of office for a long time. But Brad actually did believe that people who were in jail deserved some humane, respectable treatment. Because he recognized most of them were there pre-trial. That's a rarity, and Boulder's a rare situation. But you wouldn't survive politically if you did that. And the reason why you wouldn't survive politically is because of what, Andy?
Because the people would throw you out for not being harsh on criminals, because those people are obviously guilty of something.
And the people are who? Us.
Yes. We the people put those people in office, so if you don't represent what we want, we're kicking you out.
So it's not a giant conspiracy. It's a reflection of who we are. If we demanded that pre-trial detainees be treated differently and with more dignity, that would be exactly what would happen.
But we, the people, have decided that you're guilty. We are. And as you have said before, we're mean. And yeah, not all of us, but we do seem to, in collective, like we're a mob and we want blood and revenge.
So...
All right, well, on to happier subjects. And from the New York Times, new U.S. sexual misconduct rules bolster rights of accused and protect colleges. I've had a really hard time with this subject. I started hearing about this years ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago, when some of the high profile, maybe they shouldn't be even considered high profile, but however you want to lay out the scenario, you have innocent scenarios where two consenting adults at this point do something, one of them claims something was not invited. And then, of course, you do have the ones where there is actually some sort of serious, you know, like we'll say rape. But in the interest of protecting a student being accused, you could run them down the whole path of the criminal justice system. They get expelled from school, and they ultimately are found to be innocent. But at the same time, how do you have someone that is truly victimized sitting in class with the person that victimized them? And that is a really big struggle because people in college are kind of forced to be in confined spaces together.
Yes, I would agree with that. they unless you drop your class, you kind of, or you don't have a lot of choice of who you're.
And so this is coming out of the Betsy DeVos Education Department, and something out of the article said the Obama administration pushed that mediation between the parties would be traumatic and thereby escalating and perpetrating a hostile environment. To that, I know that you have said stuff about Scalia saying you have a right to that confrontation. Bring it. That's part of the Constitution. And then on the flip side, so the current administration, these are serious charges. They can be, and these can be big boy charges. Shouldn't the accused be afforded all the protections of the Constitution, including the right to face their accused person?
Well, that's kind of the crazy notion that I believe. I believe that, and I think I put this article in for this week, and I put it in for the very reason that I wanted to, on the rare opportunity that I can be complimentary of this administration. I want
you
to
sound
do
like
so.
a republic tard.
And I've found so little to be complimentary of this administration about that this, I said, well, I've got to do this because I think that the Obama rules went too far, and the proper balance between the accused and the accused was not respected, and the presumption of innocence was not respected. And I'm glad to see them moving in this direction. Now, these are just proposals. The Betsy DeVos's office, the Secretary of Education, said that this is all premature, that this is the deliberative process taking place. But by all accounts, if these recommendations actually do go into effect, I think it would restore the proper balance of what we're looking for, at least get us closer to that. So those of you who say I never said anything good about The administration. I'm saying something good about the administration tonight.
Mark the date and time.
I'm all about policy. I'm looking for policies I can support. And this is a policy that I can support coming out of this administration.
And I don't know that I've shared this on the podcast. I know that I lean left, but I really don't care about which team you are, because we have talked about you could go to your politician and present them with pro-registry changes to a conservative, same as you could to a liberal, and both sides hate us. One side is a little bit less hateful of us than the other, but you can make pro-registry reform or abolishment arguments to both sides.
You're right. You, on the conservative side, you tend to get more pushback unless they've personally experienced it. It all changes when they know someone.
Of course.
They all say, oh, well, yeah, we've gone too far, but it'd be political suicide for me to try to, oh, I can't do that.
Yeah.
And they're right. There would be a potential of suicide. I just pulled down the Obama administration letter from 2011. It's 19 pages, so we won't be able to go over that on the podcast tonight. But I am going to save it, so we might want to talk about it on a future podcast.
Let's move on to the appeal.org. In Pennsylvania, defendants pay a fee just to plead guilty.
I think I put that one in.
I wouldn't be surprised. You are very much on the pro indigent kind of defense thing. And that's what the article, you don't necessarily know how someone is financially, but there is some sort of cap if you are of a good socioeconomic status that they will refuse you to have a public defender. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So then in here, of the $900,000 collected, $570,000 of the fees collected came from people with public defenders. So roughly 2/3 of it came from the poor people. And that
isn't that a great ratio, Andy? Don't you love it?
Dude, that's awesome. So the people that can least afford to are the ones affording it. And actually, this comes from Joshua Vaughn, who is a very pro-criminal justice reform journalist in the Pennsylvania area.
I was flabbergasted when I saw that.
And you know, they're not even exorbitant numbers, depending on what, I mean, if you're making $7 an hour, $25 is probably something significant. But they talked about someone who pled guilty to some charges of marijuana, sentenced to 12 months and 30 days, 12 months in jail, 30 days probation. And he was also ordered to pay nearly $1,000 in fines and fees and $160 that went toward a plea fee. And it was good grief. So then in another case, a woman stole $25 in merchandise and then was hit in nearly $600 in plea fees. You know, other than Lindsay Lohan, who was running around being a kleptomaniac all the time, who's got millions of dollars, people probably aren't just running around thieving stuff if they've got the cash to support it, generally speaking.
Well, and the sad thing about it is what the reality is, a lot of these people end up not being able to pay the fees and end up, the system has to consume more time processing them.
Right.
Kind of like the technical registry violations we talked about in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
You end up with these people going through the revolving door of violating their conditions of their unsupervised probation or their supervised probation, whichever it is. They didn't pay their fees. They get hauled into the court system again. They sit in the county lockup. They spend a whole bunch of money trying to get that money, and they end up losing money. And a conservative would normally tell you that they would be against such a thing. But when you go take this type of thing to them, they get riled up and say, well, we can't just let these people get away with not paying. I mean, they didn't have to do the crime. And we need the damn hardworking taxpayers can't pay the cost of this justice system. These people need to be held accountable. And part of that is paying costs related to their misdeed. And if we don't make them pay the cost, they got to have a consequence. So, of course, we got to lock them up. I said, well, you're spending $30,000 a year, lock them up because they didn't pay $1,000 in costs. I mean, I'm doing the math and I can't come out to make your numbers add up. Say you're fiscal conservative and you believe in doing things that are proven. And by golly, I do. But I'm going to lock these people up till they learn they have to pay and comply and they have to be accountable for what they did. Otherwise, we just might as well not even have the laws. What the hell's wrong with you? That's the kind of reaction I get.
I'm right. And that's penny smart and dollar foolish, I guess.
Yes, I will tell you a story, and I won't name the name of the prosecutor, but
that's fine.
I had a prosecutor who doesn't prosecute anymore, but he was fighting that very battle of a person who was going through the revolving door over fines and fees. And he told a retired judge, I believe it was Victoria Grant, but he told her, we want to just dismiss the charge. And she says, you can't do that. Why do you want to dismiss the charge? And the prosecutor says, because they win. We're spending more money, more time messing with this. And for $97 or whatever it is, let's just let it go. Well, we can't do that. I mean, we can't do that. Well, I'm the state. I can do that. And I'm doing that. I'm dismissing this case. We're not going forward with any more prosecution. but it's like everybody's wired around that. We can't let them get away with it. So you're willing to spend a whole lot more money trying to collect your fees. It's kind of like the making people pay for their jail stay. There's jurisdictions that have tried to require people to pay. And they spend a lot of money creating bureaucracy. If they've got a 2,500 person jail, and they want to try to assess fees for people who are serving time in the jail, they create this bureaucracy of people who have a job, because in order to build them and calculate, that requires staffing, and then you try to have to go through a civil process to collect it. It's a civil obligation, so you have to file a lawsuit. So you're filing lawsuits. You're trying to collect from people who can't pay. That's why they were in jail to start with. Usually there's an economic component to most people's being in the offender category. Not always, but there's more often than not. And you spend all this money. Of course, once those jobs get created, no one wants to eliminate their own job. So if you come in there and say, well, we need to abolish this, we're spending too much money. Everybody who works in that collections unit, they'll tell you how vital their service is. Oh, man, we need this. We're keeping the community safe.
Yeah.
These things
and now we're getting the people ready for when they get out, because they'll know how to manage money and maintain a job.
Oh, I think I put this in here because of the absurdity of.
It still seems to me that it is in, I don't even see any exceptions. It is in our interest, if the person is going to get out, which, you know, pretty much everybody is, that we should get people out as quickly as possible and as prepared as possible. Almost like, hey, we're gonna set you up for some level of like standardized tests. It's almost going to be like you're going to go through school, where you're going to have to pass some grades, you're going to have some milestones to get through, and when you achieve X status, maybe not everybody gets there at the same time. Maybe some 19-year-old kid who grows up in the ghetto doesn't have a whole lot of education. Maybe it takes him a little longer to get out. Somebody that goes in with a little bit more clue about how the world works can get out sooner. Maybe that's not fair. I'm just kind of throwing it out there that way, that it's in our interest to get these people back on the street, to have a job, to support society, to clean up trash on the sides of the road as part of a volunteer project, to pay taxes and, you know, consume in the economy if we're a capitalist driven society.
I agree.
I don't see how the alternative makes any sense whatsoever.
It doesn't.
But that's who we are as a society.
It doesn't. It makes you feel good, though. It requires deep analytical thinking to think some of this stuff through. It does feel good to think that the criminal's going to pay. If you're out shoplifting, by golly, you're going to pay, and to pile all these fees on them. But you set yourself up for a cycle that you don't want, that you don't want to pay for, because they're not going to pay for it. They're not going to be able to in most cases. And you set yourself up for, and then you wonder why you have five times the incarceration rate of every other civilized nation on earth.
Yes.
And you're shocked that you have this, but yet you're not willing to look at yourself and figure out that you're part of the reason why we have this astronomically high incarceration rate. That's what puzzles me.
Yeah, it's very strange. Very strange. Well, are you ready to move on to this Court of Appeals?
I guess so.
What are these things called? The sentence, the results, what are they called?
What do you mean? What are they
called?
What
is the paperwork that, you know, I'm looking at a webpage. What is the thing called where the, yes, I decided to skip the police story. I did, because okay. I don't see any reason. I mean, like, okay, so one of the guys that killed a kid gets convicted.
Only did he get convicted, he got sentenced, and that rarely happens. So it was one of those, I preach accountability. We had accountability. That's what I wanted to mention about that. Part of our system, fixing our system, is holding people who do bad things accountable. And a police officer was finally held accountable for shooting someone without justification.
Right. And yeah, he shot a 15-year-old kid. So a white officer shot a black kid
in the back
because he was a threat, I guess, from some sort of reverse Tai Chi judo chop. I don't know.
Well, it was a car. They said that they felt threatened. It was back in the car toward them, but the video camera didn't realize, did not confirm that. It was just the opposite, fleeing. But
it's ridiculous.
But we had accountability, and that's all. That's enough.
Okay, I only skipped it just because it's like, here we go again. But just if that's the side of it, I'm trying to see what the tie is over to our side. But
holding people accountable for prosecutorial misconduct. When people do over the top behavior, if there's never any accountability, we can't stop misbehavior unless there's accountability. What they say about criminals needs to apply to the system as well.
Fair.
If you've got a prosecutor withholding evidence, accountability.
Fair.
If you've got a prosecutor mischarging, misapplying the law, accountability. And we finally held a police officer accountable for an unjustified killing. I think it's a great day.
Sure. Did he get an appropriate sentence, or did he get all of the killings of all the people that have happened?
He got 15 years.
That could sound a lot. That could sound a little.
Yeah, well, at least he got convicted and got something.
Sure. Okay.
I'm not one of those who believes that. I'm not going to sit around and second guess what the sentence was. He got prosecuted, he got convicted, and he got sentenced. Too many people gripe about what someone gets. I'm happy that he was held accountable.
All right. Well, here is a decision from the United States Courts of Appeal for the Seventh Circuit, and this is out of, oh, good grief, Illinois? Yeah, Illinois. So as I understand it, the story is homeless guy goes into the registration office to do his probably monthly or weekly registration, and the clerk says, we're not registering homeless people today. And since he doesn't have an address, he can't leave saying, hey, I came to register, here it is. They don't have time to take down some form or fashion of description. Maybe they don't have the policy to do this. And so they turn him away. And then through some other misdemeanors or some other reasons, he comes under the radar of the police. Then they obviously he hasn't registered, so they arrested him. And here is an appeals court that actually upheld the decision that if you're homeless, you're kind of screwed to being on the registry in Illinois. But yeah,
possibly. Clearly, this decision didn't go in favor of the challengers. But to comply with SORA, they recall in Illinois, the Sex Offender Registration Act, any sex offender residing in Chicago for 3 days or more must register at police headquarters. And the offender must provide law enforcement with comprehensive biographical information, including identification and proof of address.
If you're homeless, that's
hard.
If
the offender has no fixed residence, he must report weekly to the department in which documents of all locations and where the person has stayed in the past 7 days. Well, that appears to be a process for people to comply with, but it looks like the intake officer said that we're not going to register you because you don't have the proper proof.
Right.
Well, he has to have proof of address or documents of where they've stayed. Now, where I'm struggling on this is not having all the pleadings on this, just having this decision. What documents? Let's imagine that we're pushing our shopping cart around downtown Omaha, and that as the sun gets low in the sky, we find a secluded place, and we're lucky that the police haven't discovered, and we lay out whatever soft stuff we've got, and we sleep there. And then as the sun rises the next morning, we roll that up so we can begin to push it around the streets of Omaha again. What documentation would you have to take to the Omaha police to show them that you've stayed in that secluded location? What would you be able to take in?
That would be hard. Not to mention, so now your shopping cart may get a flat tire, and now you're just roaming this. This is ridiculous.
Well, so what I'm struggling is they are quoting a section of the statute that says, 153A of the ILCS, and which I assume means Illinois compiled statutes, but they're saying that the person, which documents all the locations, he must report weekly to the department, which documents all the locations where the person has stayed. Well, there would be no documents. Yeah. I guess you would just tell them that you stayed at the bridge underneath it, at the corner of Fifth.
Perhaps Ross. You've left some DNA evidence that you could use as evidence to your recent stay there that they could get the CSI lab to go pick up. to prove your DNA was there.
But it says an intake officer is not obliged to register all comers. Before registering any offender, the officer must determine whether the offender has complied with SORA's requirements. If he has, the officer registers. If not, the officer turns him away. Well, I'm confused by that. If you won't register them, how can they comply?
Yes, and yeah, I'm with you. And my layperson interpretation of it said, if the state is going to try and take away your liberty and you have a due process, then there should be a process to ensure that your due process isn't violated in taking away your liberty. And that isn't in place.
Apparently not, according to the Sixth Circuit, but not having all the this is an appellate level decision, which means there was a lot of litigation below in the lower court before it ever got to court appeals, which we don't have. It's just when Montgomery, who was the guy's name, told the intake officer he was homeless. The officer responded that the department was not registering homeless people right now. Nearly 7 months later, after arresting Montgomery for violating several ordinances, police discovered he had failed to register. They charged him with the violation which he was ultimately acquitted. Well, that's kind of strange there that he was acquitted.
Right.
Okay. Well, this is going to sound a little uncaring, but has he been harmed if they charged him and he was acquitted? Who prevailed?
Okay, I'm with you. So the state could just say let it go, but I'm going to then guess that they appealed.
Well, you cannot appeal an acquittal.
So then how did this go to the next level, do you speculate?
Well, it looks like they brought a 1983 claim trying to which is a section of U.S. Code where people who say their civil rights have been violated. He may have wanted compensation. They're giving him the pleadings from below, but he may have wanted compensation for all of this, and he may have wanted a declaratory relief that they couldn't refuse to register sex offenders. When he may be trying to establish that when he shows up to the registry office, they have a duty to register, because it's at one point of the opinion they say that he asserted a right to register, so I'm guessing without the underlying documents that he may have asserted that he had that they had caused him pain and suffering plus incarceration. And it was their fault that they didn't register him. Therefore, they should be admonished and he should be awarded money because they refused to register.
This sounds have referred to this as a second bite at the apple. That's what this, what you're, to me, sort of what you're describing then is he got off and then he went into, oh, well, hey, maybe I can get more if I've already won.
Well, a lot of people feel like that way when they're found not guilty, which does happen occasionally. I think I knew of a not guilty verdict in the last 10 years. But then they want compensation and they want to be made right. And our system doesn't work that way. Being found not guilty, boy, this is going to heckle some people, is not the same as being found innocent.
We talked about that from your CLE class.
The not guilty means that there was not sufficient proof to meet the burden beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't say we pronounce you're innocent. So therefore, without proof of actual innocence, he clearly did not register. We know that because everybody stipulated to that. What we don't know is why he didn't register, other than the fact that he says that they wouldn't register him. And he asserted he had a right to register. the court says the first claim is the weakest. The plaintiffs argue that they have a right to register sex offenders, but saying that one has a right to register under SORA is like saying that one has the right to serve a sentence or the right to pay taxes. SORA's registration requirement burdens sex offender. It's not, as the plaintiffs contend, an aspect of their liberty.
Okay. So it kind of moves off into the silly end, I think, as you said earlier, before we started recording.
Well, I'm thinking that this was an a creative attempt to get possibly some financial recovery and possibly for getting a declaration that you have to register people when they show up. And the federal court declined to do that. They said you don't have to register people who don't meet the requisite registration requirements. But it seems a little bit arbitrary and capricious of what they tell when they tell people, if you're homeless, let's admit that you're probably transportation challenged.
Likely.
In all likelihood. Better than 50-50 odds are that you're transportation challenged.
Probably a lot higher.
If you're transportation challenged, getting to a registry office is very inconvenient to start with, which means if you show up in a good faith effort to comply and they refuse you, there is some responsibility on the part of the state that you're not timely if they refuse to register you when you show up. I mean, maybe I'm missing something.
No, I think you're right. I mean, you know, they give you the tiny little window to get there. So you've kind of moved mountains to get there. You know, you have a 72 or 48 hour window, depending on the state, I guess, to get there. So you've moved mountains to make it, depending on if you're in a rural county or not. It might have been something pretty monumental for you to get there.
Mm-hmm. It says this brings us to the next theory, that freedom from the possibility of incarceration is a cognizable liberty interest in its own right. The plaintiffs offer no support for this position. That's what they allege. Certainly the 14th Amendment does not protect a person's freedom from fear of apprehension. And then they cite a 1976 case from the U.S. Supreme Court. So they really did knock their claims down pretty solidly with dismissing them all out of hand and saying that that they did not bring a good cause of action in federal court. That's not to say that the same action brought in a state court might not have more traction. It might mean that tweaking the claim slightly might come out with a different outcome, but it's not the court's job to save you from not properly pleading your case. They're supposed to be neutral, right?
I thought so.
Well, they did not save these people. And I don't want to be critical, having read all the pleadings.
Sure.
You know, it could be an attorney that I have great respect for that was trying to be creative. You never know how far you can go until you go there and don't succeed.
Yeah, we were talking about that when I was on the road the other day. Can I go to this state and not have to worry about registering? You're like, I don't know. Nobody's ever tried it before. Give it a shot. We'll see what happens.
So this attorney may have said, well, I think that we might can fit this under 1983. If we win, we're going to get attorney's fees and costs. And we're gonna provide guidance in terms of them declining, because it's a serious problem. I'm not minimizing the problem. If you make your way to the registry office as a homeless person, and they decline, well, any person for that matter, if you make your way, but particularly if you're homeless and you have a much more frequent obligation of weekly in Illinois, and many states, and then you make it to there, they refuse to register and process. That's a
frankly,
problem.
That is a so big not, day. I mean, like I tell my boss, it's like, here is a day that you cannot F with me. I will be stressed to the max. I'm going into the wolf's den with the wolves, and they're loaded with guns and tasers, and they're going to F with me, and it could be a bad day. This is not a day to play with. And I, you know, I mean, it is
absolutely
a highly stressful day. The first time I registered, I was freaked out. I would be there late. The car would break down on the way, and then I'm totally screwed. So to have somebody that has all of the extra challenges of being homeless, money, transportation, food, just life and safety in general, that is a screwed up way to make someone live.
It is indeed. And that's why I want to get registration, since it is a civil regulatory scheme. I want to get it out of the hands of law enforcement, because it should be handled by a regulatory agency rather than law enforcement. We don't need people with guns and tasers around you processing a civil proceeding, do we?
Absolutely. I think that makes, that is the creative way to handle this. I think it's a hilarious thing, but I say hilarious and like, dude, you're a smart MF. I like your ideas.
Well, I want you to come back to me and tell me why we need law enforcement handling a civil regulatory scheme when it's just, as the Supreme Court said, it's a little different than renewing your driver's license. Okay. Well, then let's just let the driver's license people handle
it. It is way, way different than just registering renewing your driver's license.
Well, at that time, they were looking at it at that time. It wasn't a lot different in 2003.
Man. Okay. Yeah.
Let's make sure that it is a civil regulatory scheme, and let's put it in a civil regulatory agency. Yeah. And people must say, well, don't you understand, if we do that then they'll mark everybody's driver's license? There's absolutely no reason for the motor vehicles to mark your driver's license.
Sure.
That's absolutely no reason for that. That's done to be extremely punitive. But they could hand you a driver's license just like everybody else, that is good for 4 or 8 years just like everyone else's. They would just simply process the registry information And that picture that they take would be your registry picture. But there's no reason for this to be handled by cops. And so since it's a civil regulatory, I want to move it to a civil regulatory framework. That's what I want to do. Of course, I really want to abolish it. But I recognize that's not going to happen. If you can't abolish something, then you make it as less painful and as less confining if you possibly can.
I don't think
can.
I have used this expression, but I think this almost should be like our motto for the whole registry movement. Don't let good be the enemy of perfect. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. If we can make some tiny little improvement that is better than nothing if we're trying to strive for perfection and we get nothing. Well, gosh, we got nothing.
Well, it's just like the removal process in California. That is the most awful removal process that they passed with their tiering system. If you're going to go to a tiering system, then there should be presumptive relief after you've been on the tiers for the number of years. So with the tiering system, California goes from having everybody lifetime to putting them in 15, 25, and lifetime tiers. But then you have to petition through a ridiculously complex process that's so politicized that very few people will ever get off under as it exists today. But it was a step. Under the previous system, you got off when you died. We now have a process that will potentially let a few people off. It will take a few years before they realize that it will be the registry will be just as bloated 5 years from now as it is today, because the removals will not be anywhere near as the additions. There'll be more additions than are removals. At that point, you can go back and have a discussion and say, here's what you did wrong. You put these things as barriers and they need to be removed. But that is an awful process. But it was a step, a very minuscule step, but it was a step. But the point we're making is that if we do nothing, then we accept the status quo. I can't abolish the registry, but I can try to make
it better. Or at least keep it from getting worse, too.
And definitely keep it from getting worse.
Well, before we make this into the 3-hour long marathon show, so let's move on to the San Francisco Chronicle article that says criminal justice system fees for 21,000 waived. Should have moved this right to that other one where the 2/3 of the money had come from the poor people. So here we have almost the same situation, but they took the fees and they just waived them and said, yeah, all right, you're good. Move on.
Well, I wasn't quite clear how they did that. It was a little unclear when I scanned the article to figure out how they did it.
They were talking about people having their wages. Excuse me. They were talking about people having their wages garnished. There were $32 million in fees that were sitting on the books. And I'm going to assume that these are people that are least able to afford to pay them, you know, a few hundred dollars here, a few hundred dollars there, then you're stuck collecting. They probably move that off to collections at some point. Now you start incurring extra fees and you just get harassing. I'm assuming that's what happens eventually.
Okay, here it is clear. I did a too quick, but under a new order by San Francisco Superior Court, which was announced publicly Thursday, the county hit. So it was a court order itself. It was. And it says Thursday's announcement builds on legislation Breed spearheaded, which I guess is a person mentioned, Mayor London Breed, when he was on the Board of Supervisors, which is equivalent to their city council. They call it Board of Supervisors. The change has knocked off $32 million, but also about $1 million, I think, in recurring revenue that they'll no longer collect.
And it's not retroactive either.
And, which means that you're going to have to either find new revenue sources or cut something else.
Can't do that.
That's competing for that $1 million. Well, no, not the. It says the point is to lift the financial burden from people leaving the criminal justice system, many of whom have low incomes and can't afford the fees. While not punitive, the fees were intended to cover the cost of criminal justice programs, but the Office of Treasurer and Tax Collector found more than 80% of the bills went unpaid, so the city received minimal benefit.
That's what you were just talking. Well, yeah, you were just talking about that on the other side.
Yeah, that you end up spending more money trying to get the money, and conservatives claim that they're so fiscally prudent that they would never do anything. That's only what liberal do-gooders do. But by eliminating the fee, the city estimates it will lose about $1 million annually. The financial hole will be filled from other parts of the city's budget, which there's lack of clarity on that. But yeah, there will be some. There were fees being collected. But $32 million were not collected. But people were paying. There are people who will do whatever they have to do to pay their fees. somehow or another they will get those fees paid because they don't want to be sitting
yeah.
in the clink.
Well, let's move on to this opinion piece in the New York Times from Lenore Skenazy, and it's talking about when fear of strangers is fatal. There was a internet video that came out that turned out to be, I think you could probably call it fake news. It got reapportioned into a different organization, but originally it was a little video clip that came out of Pakistan where two kids stand on the street playing ball or something like that. Guy on a motorcycle drives up, snatches one of the kids, and hauls ass off. And the article was like, hey, look, protect your kids. But then some other groups got a hold of it. They clipped out some pieces and they actually turned it into like, here is video of a child being abducted. You don't know where it's taken. But in some other cases, and this, she's profiling actually some other situations that have happened in other countries where there was a total beatdown, where someone was actually like, hey, look, I'm grandma and here's my family and we're looking for directions. And someone then attributes them to being some sort of child abductor group and they go beat the shit out of them. And a couple of them end up in the hospital with very severe injuries and comas. And here we are in the United States with the same thing of this fear of stranger danger. And we talked about this very much earlier in the show. So in 2011, the most recent year the U.S. Department of Justice has hard numbers for, 105 American children were taken in a stereotypical kidnapping. That is the kind of stranger abduction you'd see on Law and Order. And that's not per day, not 105 people per day. That's 105 per year. Where does this mindset come?
I mentioned that earlier. Yeah. Early in this episode, we've got, and that number has hovered in the low hundreds for a long, long time. You don't have any massive, and of course, as the population grows, 105 people being abducted in 1970 is a lot less. I mean, it's a lot more. It's a lot less today if you have 105 people being abducted in 2018 because the population of the United States is up from 200 in 1970 to 303 million now. So we're about 180, 190 million back then. So it's actually your child is safer. And I've said that your child is safer today than any time to be alive. Your child is the safest time to raise a child. You couldn't have picked a better time to raise a child today in terms of safety from criminality. Now, they're not safe from internet bullying. They're not safe from sexual assault from people who they trust. But in terms of stranger danger, and being a random victim or criminal, you couldn't have found a better time to raise a child than today.
And not probably excluding the U.S., infant mortality is the lowest worldwide than it ever has been, and nutrition is up and so forth. There are all these things that make today the best time to live.
It's the best. It's like people never realize what a great time it is to raise it.
And since you've been here since dirt, you've seen all of the times to compare.
Absolutely, I've seen the average child today is so much. Now, I don't have a lot of respect for children's laziness and how fat the obesity epidemic that we have, because they're with their PlayStation or whatever it is kids do these days, rather than going out playing football and riding bicycles and doing things that they should do as healthy adolescents. But in terms of safety, you couldn't have a better opportunity to raise a child from keeping them safe from dangers. They don't have to work in unsafe factories like they did at one time in our world. They're not out on the farm like they were working long hours. It's a great time to be alive. but that was sad. I read that all these people that got beat up in Pakistan and India, I think it said, they were totally innocent because of the video. And we do the same thing here. We elevate something that's a problem if it's your one. A tragic accident is a problem when it's you. Absolutely. Unsafe drivers that are texting, they are a problem, particularly when they hit you. But we don't have an epidemic of child abductions in the United States of America. We don't. Sorry, but we don't. Oh, I got the guy at the conference in Atlanta would say that these are fake statistics.
Probably. As his head was spinning around, saying you're a libtard.
A libtard. I love
that. Do you remember what we did? I think it was episode 2. Do you remember?
That's so long ago. That was back in 1994, wasn't it?
We covered polygraphs. It's episode 2 or 3, somewhere very early on. We covered the polygraph stuff. And
Oh, okay. I do remember the Polygon
And
show, yes.
leading up to it, I thought you and I were on the same page as far as like that it's pretty much bullshit. But you were like, no, we use it. It's good. And then I talked to you, and then you went and talked to somebody you know, and you were like, oh, wait a minute. Maybe I need to adjust myself. So why this comes out on my feed this week, I don't know, because it's a three-ish year old article. It's a YouTube video that Bloomberg did with a guy named Doug Williams, and he's a certified polygrapher. And for quite some time, he's been a huge advocate of what the bullcrap is of the poly. And so here's a little clip from the YouTube video that is from his, right from the horse's mouth.
Polygraph is not a test. It's an intense interrogation. And the only part the polygraph plays is to frighten and intimidate a person into making a confession or an admission. It doesn't record truth or deception. There is no such thing as a lying reaction. It records nervousness. The reaction that would brand you as a liar only indicates deception about 50% of the time.
I wanted to bring that to, not to send you off into the wild and have you go do all kinds of the wrong things knowing that you can pass a lie detector test, but just to highlight what the point of the thing is to make you nervous so that you'll admit that you did something wrong. That's it.
That's what my expert, he said it was no better than a coin toss. He said, but it does extract confessions, which I've right. experienced when we've taken the exam results to our clients and said, why is it that you're showing a lot of problems with this question? Then they fess up and say, well, the reason why I'm showing deception is because I did it. So the tool worked. It did what it, but people often, unfortunately, continue to blab, particularly sex offender polygraphs, when they tell them they're showing deception. The response should be, I'm sorry, I'm being completely truthful. I don't understand why you're getting that, and stick with it. But they don't. But I have certainly changed my opinion about the thing, because my expert, who wishes to remain anonymous, who's administered thousands of tests in his career, said that it's not much better than a coin toss. He said he would hate to rest his future on that device.
And in there, he tells you how to pass it. And he essentially says, hey, during the question that you may have problems with, think about you laying on the beach with the waves lapping over your body. And when you're doing the control questions, hey, what's your name? What's your address? And you do those things. Think about you falling off a 100-story building, your face smashing into the concrete, and you will throw the results of the test off, only to show you that it just shows a nervousness response. It doesn't tell you that you're lying or anything like that. It's complete pseudoscience. And me personally, I have a mission in my life to expose pseudoscience for what it is. Anti-vaxxers, this polygraph stuff, the registry myth, stranger danger, those are all pseudoscience and just fear-mongering, and it drives me absolutely insane.
Well, like I say, you've converted me along with my expert. I did not know what I knew until I had the off-the-record discussion.
All right.
And I've learned a lot about the pseudoscience of polygraphs, and I would hate to rely on them other than trying to extract a confession, which they're quite good at doing.
Well, we have just really one article left, and then sort of like a shout out to someone. This one is very disturbing, Larry. This is out of theappeal.org, and a case for an intellectually disabled teen falsely accused of sex offense reveals registry flaws. And as I read the article, so it's a 15-year-old boy. He's got an IQ of 78, which is, you know, that's Lenny and Squeaky kind of territory for that's a very intellectually deficient person. And so he's 15, and his maybe girlfriend or whatever. So the 14-year-old, they have sex, and mom caught them as the girl was getting redressed. And now she's under interrogation by the parents. So she says, he raped me. That starts that whole train coming down the path. And 2 months, after he gets convicted and sentenced and all that, she recants her testimony. But he's now convicted, and now he's in the whole regime of the sex offender, and he can't get out. And what is he being treated for? If it makes no sense, you've taken away what the foundation of what he quote unquote needed to be treated for, but that's been evaporated. But now he's still in the treatment program.
Yeah, isn't this a great?
This is
situation?
Awesome. This is one of the better ones that I've seen come across my feed.
spokesperson for the Virginia Department of Juvenile Justice said the state uses relapse prevention as one treatment option, adding that its program utilizes an individualized, holistic, and cognitive, behavioral, and strengths-based approach, which encompasses individual, group, and family therapies. End of
but
quote.
He's not guilty of anything, so what is he being traded for? It's like, I'm baffled by this one. This one just blows my mind. But he's going to be in the system because they got another bad one off the street, so to speak.
Well, he pleaded guilty to raping Fran, so he maintained his innocence and said he only had consensual sex. And then, like you say, the court-appointed attorney advised him to enter a guilty plea to avoid being charged as an adult, which was one of the things that happens. If you don't do this, we'll do this. And then after he was sentenced, the girl recanted. And that gets into a problem of trying to undo a guilty plea. He pled guilty. He admitted to the factual allegations that he did by guilty plea. Now what do we do?
He's not guilty of a crime to begin with. The whole thing should just be like wiped. Roll back.
Well, how do we do that?
I don't know what the legal process would be, but there was obviously the legal process that started it. But if you've wiped out the foundation of it, he's not guilty of a crime. So his statement was made under duress.
Well, it says Coker was eventually released in the Circuit Court of Stafford County, vacated his charges. But despite his innocence, Coker underwent therapy at Hanover to prevent him from sexually reoffending.
Yeah, so maybe the jail time is done, but he's still in the stupid treatment program. So anyway, all right. Well, the last thing that I have is I learned of a podcast from Emily Horowitz. She was interviewed on Thaddeus Russell's program called it's Unregistered, actually. And interesting program. He does a really good job. It's very conversational. Just they sit down like in a coffee shop almost. And he talks to her. The one thing that I didn't know about the... did you watch the debate between her and Marcy Hamilton at the Soho Forum?
Yes, okay. That was quite
the
funny.
The thing that you'll... Yeah, I know. Well, the thing that came out, he said, it is my understanding that you destroyed her. And she's very humble. And she's like, well, I don't know about that. It's like from they take a poll of the people at the beginning of the debate and then they poll them afterwards. And it doesn't matter who wins or loses the debate, but who moves the most number of people. And Emily moved more people than they've ever had in their forum. I don't know if they've had 5 debates or 500 debates, but she moved more people to that the registry is garbage than any other debater on any subject that they've had in their history, which is pretty stellar. So go to the website, go to the Registry Matters website. There's a link to it in the show notes to get you to it's episode 62 at ThaddeusRussell.com for the podcast. Stellar, stellar, stellar interview that she is. We have to get rid of the registry. And she's a sociologist and a criminologist, and she says that it doesn't do anything to protect anybody. It gives you a false sense of security. From a policy standpoint, it doesn't make any sense. From a criminologist standpoint, it doesn't make any sense. So all of the talking points that we need to have as a people, as a group of people pushing against this, she lays it out for you in that 90-minute interview. I totally know that, and she keeps pushing me back. She is waiting. She's working on a research paper, and she doesn't want to just come on and talk to our people about the things that we already know. She wants to have something new in the pipeline to discuss. It is in the works and will happen. It's on her schedule. She's a busy lady with 4 kids, and she's a professor at a college in New York City. But super awesome.
Well, we shall go listen.
They're very worth listening to.
It's ThaddeusRussell.com podcast 62. Now, how do people get in touch with us?
That's the next part of this. The website is registrymatters.co. If you want to call in and leave a voicemail, you can call in at 747-227-4477. Love getting voicemail messages that we can play on the podcast and answer questions. I know that Larry loves to answer deep, penetrating questions like our man from East Baton Rouge Parish last week. Throw me an email message at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or of course support us at Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters. Go and subscribe to YouTube, youtube.com/c/registrymatters, and follow us on Twitter at registrymatters on Twitter.
And I did finally reach that person that had sent a private communication wanting to know about how to no one would take the case because it was a sex offender, and We agreed to do some further exploration, and it may not be the greatest case, but we did talk, and we agreed to talk again. And it was quite an interesting conversation. I'm glad I could do it for you. Until we start having 50,000 listeners, I do try to speak to people who reach out to us.
Larry, as always, thank you very much for joining me, and we'll do it again next week.
Well, thanks, Andy. See you in about 168 hours. No, it'd be 165 hours because we start. Yeah. So, all right. Thanks.